Welcome to the InnovaBuzz podcast, where we share all kinds of tips, advice, and interview guests on all things innovation and leadership in modern marketing. Each episode is a conversation with inspiring people who make wonderful contributions to our knowledge in these areas and spark curiosity and ideas to pursue. Join me, Jürgen Strauss from InnovaBiz, and let's get into today's masterclass on this InnovaBuzz podcast.
And so it took me some years of experimentation, action research really, to figure out how to get democratic classes to work. And I found out that it doesn't just happen from the beginning. There's a whole lot of other things you have to do first to invite people into a partnership with you and to work on their expectations and your own so that your expectations and theirs align with each other. And then when they're ready, you can throw it open to them and it can become a collective exercise in design and intervention and research and everything else.
Hi there, innovator. It's great to be back with another episode. I hope you've had an awesome week so far. And I trust you enjoyed my recent conversations with Emmy Award-winning producer and director Nick Nanton and with the author of Creativity Over Perfection, Heather Lee Dyer. I'm really excited to have on the InnovaBuzz podcast as my guest today, Bob Dick, who's an expert in action research methodology and in action learning methodology. Bob is a scholar, an educator, a facilitator, a coach, and a change consultant. His early training was as an experimental psychologist, and he discovered the action research methodology almost by accident, as he tells us on the conversation, and developed it in his own style into a highly effective approach to both change management and to learning. Bob's focus is in consultancy and facilitation work that's stimulating, worthwhile, and helps to make the world a better place. He works with highly participative teams with a wide involvement of those people who have a stake in what's happening. A quick promotional message from our sponsor, InnovaBiz, where we help coaches and consultants build professional credibility, engage their target audience, and connect with their ideal clients. To give you absolute clarity about who your ideal clients are and how you can help them, take a look at our Marketing Master mini class. In less than 30 minutes, you'll gain absolute clarity on your ideal client and how you can communicate with them to build and strengthen an engaging, enduring relationship. Access the Marketing Master mini class at innovabiz.co/marketingmaster. It's completely free and accessible without even giving away your email. In our discussion today, Bob talked to me about what action learning and action research is and how it relates to continuous improvement. He explained why it's important to focus on who your ideal clients are and what their expectations and expected outcomes are. And he also explained that the process is important, and so too is the people-to-people relationship. Without further ado then, let's fly into the hive and get the buzz from Bob Dick. Hi, I'm your host, Jürgen Strauss from InnovaBiz, and I'm really excited to welcome to the InnovaBuzz podcast today from Brisbane in Australia, Bob Dick, who's an independent scholar, a facilitator, and a change consultant. So welcome to the InnovaBuzz podcast, Bob. It's a real privilege to have you as my guest.
Thank you, Jürgen.
Now, Annette Coy and Cameron Fee, who were our guests on episode 204 of the InnovaBuzz podcast, suggested that we have a conversation with you, Bob. So a big hello to Annette and Cameron.
Thank you.
Now, Bob, you describe yourself as a designer of organization and group level processes. You use concepts and processes from action learning and and facilitation to help people, help teams, organizations, and communities to improve their work, to improve their learning, and to improve their life. So that's a pretty big mission. And a lot of that involves facilitation and change skills and models and methodologies and perspectives that you've researched and developed over many years that are all related to action research methodology. So I'm really looking forward to finding out more about all that today and see how you tackle change and how you apply the action research methodology. Now, before we start talking about all things change, give us a bit of a background on action research methodology. What exactly is it?
It's a more formal version of what most of us do anyway. If we're faced with an unexpected situation that we haven't encountered before, then typically we collect a bit of information to try to figure out what's going on. We develop some hunches about what might be a way forward. We try something, and if it works, we then try something a bit further. And if it doesn't work, we fine-tune it and have another go and see if this variation on what we first tried worked. And that's what action research is like. It means that we try to be responsive to the situation as it is, and we're open to the unexpected, and we try to respond to it in constructive ways. So that's one piece of it, and that's kind of the action research process. It's a cycle that alternates between having a look at what's happening and then trying to figure out what's a way forward. The other piece of it is that in the practice of most action researchers, it's highly participative. And that is that if I'm acting as a facilitator, I'm trying to give equal voice to the people I'm working with. And my goal then is to help them achieve whatever it is that they want to achieve. Common saying amongst action researchers is that we research with people, not on people. And and so it's a research methodology and a change methodology bound up in one process. And it typically involves anyone who's directly affected by either the situation or where it's likely to go. So there's a thumbnail sketch of action research.
Okay. Well, yeah, that's great. So I guess there's a couple of things in that I'd love to unpack some more. I mean, one of the things that strikes me is that it's very much, you know, action is a key word there, that you actually take action and then you kind of look at how that action impacts on what you're trying to influence and then adapt to the results that you're getting and make changes as appropriate. But the other thing that I really like is working with people on change. So how did you first get started with this and become interested in pursuing that methodology and really developing it as a methodology and formalizing it, as you said?
It happened in bits and pieces, and some of it formal and some of it not. I did an undergrad program in experimental psychology, and in experimental psychology you learn a lot about research. But a particular sort of research, and a lot about pieces of people like motivation and perception and memory, but you don't learn much about people as people and even less about people in groups. And in my final year, I had a scholarship to do it full time, and so I actually had more time than I was used to having. And so I sat in on a class in applied psychology. I think it was called something like industrial and organizational psychology. And I asked the lecturer, John Dam, his name was, is it okay if I sit in on your class? And he said, yes, you're most welcome. And I said, if I do, will you treat me as if I were formally enrolled? I can't enroll formally. I don't have the prerequisites, but I'll do any field work that there is. I'll do all the assignments. And he said, if you behave like that, I'll treat you as if you're a class member. And on the strength of that, I then worked in the Commonwealth Department of Labor for 3 years And then when John went on study leave, after 3 years, he borrowed me from the public service to run his university classes, even though I had never formally qualified. Now, the methodologies that I'd been taught as an undergrad psychologist didn't work in the field. They weren't flexible enough. Research was something that was different to change. And so the notion was that researchers and change agents were different people. And I was working in the Department of Labor as an applied psychologist, and I was doing very applied research, case studies, offering an information service to people. And I'd heard about action research from John Dam, this lecturer whose lectures I sat in on, and so I started using that. But really it all happened in the classroom. That in Department of Labor, it was a marvelous job for somebody like me who would spend my life immersed in books if the world would let me. And I was expected to spend a couple of days a week reading so that I was up to date with the literature on industrial democracy and employee participation and change management. And so I went into the university classroom with my head full of the principles of industrial democracy. And I thought all I had to do was to say to people, I don't know what's in this class. We're going to work that out between us. And I thought they would respond with energy and enthusiasm. And instead they responded with anxiety. This was so different to what they expected. They didn't know how to react to me. And so it took me some years of experimentation, action research really, to figure out how to get democratic classes to work. And I found out that it doesn't just happen from the beginning. There's a whole lot of other things you have to do first to invite people into a partnership with you and to work on their expectations and your own so that your expectations and theirs align with each other. And then when they're ready, you can throw it open to them and it can become a collective exercise in design and intervention and research and everything else. So it happened over my first 4 or 5 years at university, experimenting, trying to get democratic classes to work in a university environment. And it all went on from there.
Okay. Well, that's fascinating. That I guess we're trained from a very young age in school and so on, that it's kind of everything's spoon-fed to us. And so that certainty that somebody's going to get in front of a classroom and spoon-feed us the information and tell us what we need to study and learn, read, or what assignments we have to do, rather than kind of, okay, you know, we're going to work this out together. And so it's fascinating to see or hear that kind of created a lot of anxiety because that certainty was removed.
One of the things that made a difference, actually, was that I always asked if I could have my classes in rooms where there wasn't fixed furniture. And I'd get in early before the class and I'd move all the tables to the back of the room and I'd arrange the chairs in a large circle if that would accommodate the class numbers so that when people walked into the room, they knew it wasn't going to be a lecture. They didn't know what it was going to be yet, but at least from the moment they opened the door and looked into the room, they knew that there was going to be something different about that. And that made it so much easier to begin to negotiate with them how we were going to work constructively together.
So what does the model of action learning then look like in that framework? So you've talked about like the environment part of it, arranging the room, and people know that this is going to be different than the classical lecture perhaps. But so what other parts of the framework are important?
It's not always really clear in the literature, but one of the important things, at least in the way I use action research, is to invest a lot of effort into what some of the change literature calls entry and contracting, finding out who the clients are and who are the direct stakeholders and what are their expectations And why have they invited a consultant or researcher in? And what are they hoping will be the outcomes from all of this? And try to do that in a way that begins to build a relationship with them. And so that we're not reacting to each other as consultant and client, but as Bob and Jurgen. So we form a person-to-person relationship so that we can be more open and honest with each other, and so that we are willing to at least initially take people on trust and see where things go rather than get anxious if they seem a bit too unexpected.
Yeah, yeah. It reminds me quite a bit of our philosophy in marketing where, you know, we start off with getting to know who the people are that we can actually help and understanding what their needs and expectations are, what their desires are, and then working with them at a personal level to address those needs and address those desires. And certainly in kind of the marketing sense of actually having interactions at a personal level and building that relationship. So it's very much like that, isn't
it? Yes, it is. That parallel hadn't occurred to me, but yes, the way you've just described marketing is a pretty good two-sentence description of action research.
All right. What are some of the practical applications that you've kind of used this for? You talked a little bit about learning in a university classroom, but I know you do a lot of workshops and facilitation in I guess workshops where you're working as a consultant to do change in organizations. So what are some of the practical applications where you bring about the action or bring in the action framework?
I use it in just about everything that I do, and so whatever I'm working on, I always try to build continuous improvement into it so that whatever I'm doing today is done building on whatever I learned from the last time I did it. In terms of formal consultancy, most of my recent work has been using I use action research and action learning as if they're kind of the same game in a way, but until recently they've been entirely separate literatures. They had entirely different provenance. Action researchers didn't reference action learning literature for the most part, and vice versa. That they began in different places with different people. And action learning, the focus is on small project teams that are given either a set of individual tasks or, more often these days, a collective team task, and they work on that. And it seems to me that that sounds pretty much like action research. You decide what your goals are. You work out tentatively what might be the track that will take you in that direction. You work out a good first step. You try it. If it works, you then take the second step. If it doesn't, you step back and reflect on why it didn't work and think, from that era, what have I learned about what's really happening in this situation? And in the light of that, what will I try differently? And I think that's a philosophy of living. It's not just a philosophy for consultancy. And the sorts of things that have – maybe it would help if I gave a kind of brief description of a typical action learning, action research project.
Yeah, that'd be great.
I was working with a group of middle managers in one unit within the state government department. There were 14 middle managers, as I recall, and they felt overloaded already, and they knew there were changes coming down the road towards them, and they were really anxious at the thought of having to manage a whole lot of extra change on top of what was already quite a demanding job. And so they asked me to join them in planning out how they can get ready for change. When I asked them, okay, let's find a project that you can use to familiarize yourself with these ways of working. They said, we're too busy to do that. And so I suggested for their first project that a small number of them volunteer to work out some ways in which they could create some spare time so that we would have the time to meet regularly and do some work together. And so I think three of them volunteered that we'll do that. And so they went away and figured out some things that would save some time despite their heavy workload. And then they brought that back as a set of proposals. And we agreed that from then on, we would meet for half a day a fortnight. And each time we met, we would get a report back from any projects they'd been working on, and we'd work out what project they wanted to work on next. And so they were learning to problem solve and decision make and work together in different ways by working on projects that they themselves had chosen. And over the course of, I think I was with them for somewhere between 18 months and 2 years, and over that time they chose probably somewhere more than a dozen projects that a small number of volunteers from within themselves would work on, and they would work on that and then report back to the 14. So the whole process was driven by the 14 of us plus me meeting every couple of weeks, and then two or three groups of them at a time who would be working on specific projects and reporting back regularly on what their experience was in doing that and what was working and what wasn't. So that by the end of 18 months, when I wrote up a report and sent it to the executive director for approval, his response was that the whole thing, from his point of view, had worked very well, that they were now much more proactive. They didn't wait to be told what to do, but were much more likely to make suggestions about what to do, or even ask for forgiveness later rather than permission first. And that was the kind of behavior he was hoping for from them. So that's one example of action research and action learning used in combination to help people prepare for some forthcoming changes that they weren't confident of being able to manage.
Yeah, what I really like about that, I mean, I'm interested in your role as a facilitator there. Clearly you had an outcome in mind, or they had an outcome in mind, and you were really clear about that. And then you kind of set up an environment where they almost applied the learning in a very small project, which was actually the project of how do we make the change, or how do we begin to make this change.
Yes, that's right. And there was some good luck in it as well too. And the second project they chose was, I said that they all had heavy workloads, but in the 14 sections, it wasn't that everybody had a heavy workload at the same time. And when some people were busy, other people were a bit less busy. And so their practice had been to go to whichever team leader had a team that was least busy and say, can we borrow one of your people to help us out of a spot? And when they reported this, they said, and what happens is that they always give us their worst performer. And when they ask us for help, we give them our worst performer.
Yeah.
And we all know that this is a ridiculous way to behave, but that's how things have happened. And so we set up an action learning team, and they came back that in future they wouldn't go directly to a team. They'd bring it back to their regular meetings, as they now become, of the 14 middle managers, and say, look, we're overloaded. And then the 14 middle managers would make a choice about who was the best person for the organization as a whole to lend to this team that was in trouble. And that saved them so much agony that after that it wasn't difficult to have their enthusiastic engagement in what we were doing. So when you're handed a piece of good luck like that, you make the most of it, and you don't count on it, but you welcome it when it happens.
Well, what I guess that raises the question, or you know, it says to me that action learning in that environment and the way you applied it was all about getting everyone working towards a common goal. So would that be true of any action learning or action research situation?
Most of the literature would agree with you there, but in fact, all you need is a situation that people would want to improve. So the goal can be as general as finding out how we can improve the situation. And in the case study I described, it was a bit like that. I mean, the goal was managing some forthcoming changes, but they didn't have any idea how they were going to do that. So it was a very, very fuzzy goal. And they developed more specific goals through trial and error as we proceeded. And I think that's typical for action research and action learning. You don't really need a goal if you have a problem situation. That's enough to get going. I guess the other thing I should say is that there's a number of things that if they're done at the start, help things to go a lot better. And there are different approaches to action research and action learning. If you were to interview a dozen action researchers, you'd probably get a dozen different descriptions about how to do it. The way I do it is that I facilitate the first meeting of the action learning team. Action learning sets, they're called. And we do some intense relationship building. I don't assume that just because they've been working together for years that they have a good person-to-person relationship with each other. So get as personal with each other as they're willing to become, to build some person-to-person relationships. And then we talk about, at this stage, what are the outcomes that you think are desirable? And so I encourage them to think about their goals in outcome terms by asking them things like, how will you know that you've been successful?
Yeah.
And we typically make a list of who are the other stakeholders that have to be engaged in some way if this is going to work. So I'm not only working participatively with each of the action learning sets, I'm encouraging them to work participatively with all of the other stakeholders in whatever the project that they're working on. And then I want to make them conscious of problem solving and decision making. And so if people are just presented with a problem, what they do is they pay attention to the problem, but not the process they use to engage with the problem. They run the process on automatic. And it might be something that has a vague resemblance to Robert's Rules of Debate, or it might be something like sitting around a table talking to each other. And so I take them through a process where they choose a couple of aspects of how they work together that they think they could do better with good outcomes. And so this is an attempt to make them more process aware, more aware of, more conscious of the way in which they actually do things. And often that's, and so there's really two sets of outcomes, I guess, and one is the particular goal they're working on. But one is that they become better at sharing leadership and using participatory decision-making and problem-solving methods. And so what they're learning about themselves and about how they work together and about how they problem-solve and make decisions, from my point of view, that's often a more important outcome than just solving a problem, because that will serve them well for the rest of their life if they're willing to let it do that. Whereas a problem is a time-contained thing, and when that's done, it's done.
Yeah, that's right. Yeah, I was just going to ask you before, how do you ensure that the changes that you've made are sustainable within the group? And that clearly is one really good way to ensure that there is sustained change, by having them understand what is the process we've used to successfully tackle this issue or improve this issue.
As I've said, I facilitate the first meeting, and at the very least, I want them to have good relationships, everyone with everyone else, at the end of that. And also, I'm building my relationship with them as we do that, so I take part in whatever activities we're doing too. At the end of that, we actually look at the two process improvements they've chosen for themselves, and we review how we've worked together in our first session against those two guidelines to get them in the practice of evaluating and learning from what they do. And then I say, which of you will volunteer to facilitate the second time we meet? Mm-hmm. And then I say, before you answer, let's make it safe for you to do that. And so whoever volunteers, any time you feel stuck, all you have to do is call time out, and we'll pause and help you to work out what's the best way forward. Or anyone else in the group can call time out if they don't understand what's going on, or I can call time out. So I'll be there as a supportive coach to make sure that if you volunteer to facilitate the next session, it will be a productive and enjoyable session for you. And so far, there's always been somebody who volunteers, and I'm there as a supportive coach. And at the end of that, somebody else then facilitates the review of that session. And then I ask, okay, who else will have a go at facilitating the third session? And often it's the person who's volunteered to do the review who does that. And I ask for the previous facilitator and the next facilitator to get together between now and the next session so that the next facilitator learns from the previous facilitator's experience. And that's a really good review for the previous facilitator as well, to be talking with somebody who's a keen listener about what I've learned from what just happened. And at the third session, I try not to intervene, so that at the end of the third session, I can say, okay, you've just demonstrated to me that you're now fully capable of managing your own process. You don't need me anymore. I would be delighted to be invited back from time to time so I can see how you're going. But from this point on, it's your show. You're for help anytime you need it. Over to you.
Yeah. Yeah, that's a great process. And the philosophy very much is basically you're training people to take on all the roles that are required in that change management process.
That's right. Aren't you? Yes.
And without that having been an expressed outcome to start with.
Because that's the outcome that will be better for them in the long run. That's the outcome that will make the big difference.
Yeah, that's great. I really like that. All right. Now, so with the, I mean, you know, one of the things I think in what you've published is you say is that teachers don't teach, learners learn. And I guess that's very much that philosophy that you've applied there. What are some of the other key things around putting together an environment where that will happen and where the chances of success for something like that model are maximized?
One of the skills that is really helpful for people is something called stakeholder analysis. And so at our first meeting, if there's time, or maybe in the second meeting, we actually, after they've been clear about what outcome they're working towards, we then make a list of all of the other people who can affect what they do or will be affected by what they do, a list of stakeholders. And then I ask them to promise that every time they're about to make an action decision, that they look at their list of stakeholders and ask, have we adequately consulted and informed and involved the people who have the most direct stake in what we're about to do? And if we haven't done that yet, how are we going to do it? And so I'm encouraging them to adopt the same kind of participatory philosophy with the other stakeholders that I've tried to model in my relationship with them. And I think that that's really an important piece of getting good outcomes, because it's often the stakeholders that we don't consult that will look for opportunities to throw a spanner in the works. It's their way of complaining about the way in which things worked out. And so getting all of the stakeholders involved in some way in the decisions to be made, I think, is an important piece of both action research and action learning. Change management generally, for that matter.
Yeah, that's a really great model, the stakeholder analysis and measuring up each individual action against individual stakeholders and making sure that you've actually brought people on board or at least kept them aware of what's happening so that they have some level of certainty as to what's going on. And certainly I know from my time in the corporate world that wasn't the typical way things were done. One of the other things I'm interested in, because you mentioned, stakeholders can throw a spanner in the works there if they don't know what's happening and so on. And a lot of times that is unconscious. People don't do it kind of deliberately. How do you address the self-sabotage that teams might do, the unconscious self-sabotaging, whether it's that they don't believe they're good enough to tackle this new situation or whether it might be other kind of inherent beliefs that get in the way?
I think that's an enormous question that you've just asked. And I also think it's crucially important. What I'm about to say might seem like a bit of a detour, but it really relates to what we're talking about in very important ways, I think. Somewhere between 6,000 and 8,000 years ago, somebody invented hierarchy and regimentation. And we're a small tribe species. There's a stack of research that says that we spent most of our life as a species in relatively small clans and villages. And when numbers reached a bit beyond somewhere around about 100, we would typically split in two because we wanted to keep things small enough that we had a person-to-person relationship with everything else. And yet we learned to build these enormous edifices called organizations that are way beyond what our pre-wiring as Homo sapiens allows us to handle well. And we've come to depend on them. And there's literature from the middle of last century that was already beginning to say that where organizations faced a lot of change, hierarchy didn't work as well as it used to. And so organizations had to begin to set up project teams and encourage more communication across the silos and evolve more genuine responsibility down towards the workplace and had to encourage people to work more often in small teams, but still maintaining the hierarchy. One of the things that I do is I collect case studies of organizations that have used very different approaches to structure. And even if they're dramatically successful, almost nobody imitates them. And so we have this set of mental models, some of the literature would call them, about what an organization looks like and what a work team looks like. And even though it no longer works, it acts as a kind of filter that prevents us seeing some more promising ways forward. And if you look at kind of an extreme example of a hierarchic organization, the notion is that at each level, people don't have any autonomy or initiative. They do what they're told. Their boss is responsible for telling them what to do and how to do it. And for many years, this was regarded as the right way to manage, to have everything driven by detailed procedures. And if the environment's changing quickly, that isn't going to work because you can't wait to get permission if the very situation you're facing changes while you're dealing with it. And so there's this massive obstacle in the form of our mental models that prevent us seeing what's a way of building large organizations that still allow people to bring all of themselves to work and to respond flexibly to what happens And I think the literature has fiddled around with this for probably since the 1940s or something like that. And yet we're still struggling to get this to work. And there are some dramatically successful case studies, examples of organizations that do things dramatically differently. And yet they're too different and people are unwilling to do it. So to come back to your question, as a team leader, how do I deal with somebody who's not performing in the team? And the temptation is to take back my control that I've tried to share with them and say, what you're doing isn't appropriate. I want you to do this instead. But if I do that, what we've done is reverted back to hierarchic ways of doing things. And that's put a roadblock in the way of moving forward. And so instead it has to be done, I think, through negotiation and sitting down with them and saying, this is my experience of how things are working for me and for you and between us. What's your perception? And then we reach agreement on what's going on here and how it might be improved. And I can illustrate this with a case example. A couple of years ago, I got a phone call from a colleague of mine, and he said something like, we lost our receptionist on the front desk, and you've got to have a receptionist on the front desk. So we had to appoint somebody, and we did, and she's awful. What do I do? And I said something like,
"Yeah,
if you could change only one thing about her behavior, what would you change?" And he said something like, I'd get her to smile at the clients when they walk in the front door. And I said something like, if you had a conversation with her about that, how do you think that would go? And he said, I don't know, I'll give it a try. And he phoned back a week or so later and said, well, she's now smiling at the clients as they walk in the door. What do I do now? And I said, okay, if you could change one more thing about her behavior, what would you now choose? And he helped her improve her behavior one thing at a time by providing her with enough context about what her responsibilities were and what his responsibilities were. And he did it in such a way that he built a good relationship with her until in the end, after about 6 months, he phoned up and said, we're in the market for another receptionist. Her skills have so improved that she's now gone on to a better job and we're now recruiting again. But the point was he didn't try to change her overnight.
Yeah.
He went on a joint journey with her through negotiation and through giving her an equal voice in how she went about improving her job in one small way, kind of one step at a time. So it's very much a continuous improvement sort of thing, and that's more often regarded as a part of the quality management processes and literature. But if you think about it, the fact that action research works in a cycle where you take in the information and you form a hunch about what's going on and you develop an idea about what a good next step would be and you try it and then you see if it worked, then it's applying that same philosophy within a team leader, team manager relationship, so that from the beginning, everybody in the team has equal voice. That's my answer to your question. And it's a long answer, but I think it's a really important question.
Yeah. Well, that's a really great example. And also, you know, approaching the performance management about focusing on one area of improvement at a time, because often people are given a whole lot of things, whether it's a learning situation or whether it's feedback, they're given a whole lot of things. And so the detail kind of overwhelms them and they don't actually take action on anything.
I've almost never encountered a formal performance management system that worked. And some of them actually did more harm than good.
Yeah.
Whereas if I've been lucky, I've had some marvelous bosses and learned from them about how to be a good boss. And for them, performance management wasn't something that you did at the end of each year or every 6 months. It was something that you did day by day.
That's right, yeah.
A boss who would say to me, here's a job. If you think you can do it on your own, it's yours. If you need any help, you know where my office is. Yell for help at any time and we'll work out how to deal with this. And I've been fortunate that more often than not, I've had bosses that were that kind of team leader. And I think it's because I actually started most of my working life after a couple of false starts as an apprentice electrician. And electricians tend to be bright, but not very materially ambitious. That vocational guidance selects people. They need to be bright to do the college work involved in electrical work. But because promotional opportunities are pretty mediocre, you don't want them to be very ambitious. And so many of the electricians I worked with as an apprentice had that style of leadership too, about giving me as much responsibility as they thought I had the skills and maturity to take on board. And so that was a really good education for me in the five-year apprenticeship I served as an apprentice electrician.
Mm.
That was a long time ago.
Yeah, well, sounds like there's an interesting journey there from electrician through to your psychology degree and what you're doing today. But I'm looking at the time. I think it's probably a great time to move on to the buzz, our innovation round. I was going to touch on feedback and how to provide feedback. There's a lot more around action learning there. You've given us a great insight, so I really appreciate that. But there is a lot more we could dig into. As I say, that time is moving on, so I think it's a good time to move on to the buzz, our innovation round, and it's designed to help our audience, who are primarily innovators and leaders in their field, with some tips from your experience. So I've got five questions, and hopefully we'll get some really insightful answers that'll inspire people to go and do something awesome today.
Okay.
So what do you think the number one thing is anyone needs to do to be more innovative?
To be who you are. To not try to be somebody that you're not, but understand your strengths and weaknesses and look for ways of making an asset of that particular package of strengths and weaknesses. I'm a fairly different personality to most of the people I've worked with as consultants and facilitators. And if I tried to be the kind of consultant and facilitator they are, it wouldn't work for me. I try to be who I am, and I try to take all of myself into whatever I do so that all of my talents and all of my weaknesses are there to be drawn on as appropriate.
Yeah, that's great advice. And I think people tend to go overboard when they look at models and say, well, what can I learn from that person? And perhaps that's the question they should be asking rather than how can I be more like that person? Great advice. What's the best thing you've done to develop new ideas?
The continuous improvement, the action research attitude about I try to set aside reflection time after each thing that I've done so that I can ask myself, what did I learn from that? And the next opportunity I have, what's something I will experiment with doing a bit differently? So I keep on looking for other ways of doing it. I think that when I fall off the perch, probably what I'll be best known for is actually a research technique called convergent interviewing, which is both a way of collecting information at interview, but also a way of making sense of the information that's collected during the interview. And I think that's now being picked up by if you do a Google search on convergent interviewing, for instance, you get something like 600 hits on Google Scholar and somewhere north of 900 or 1,000 on the conventional Google engine. And these are people who've just found this is a really learnable and effective interviewing technique. And it happened little bit by little bit. I'd try something and that worked, so that became part of the package, and it all began, I don't know, probably 40 years ago now. So 40 years of improvement means that convergent interviewing is now a fairly potent research tool.
Yeah, yeah. All right, that's great. Sounds fascinating. We'll have to post some links to that on the show notes for this. Now, do you have a favourite resource that you use most often?
I have a head full of models and theories. I'm more conscious of what I'm doing as I do it than almost any consultant and facilitator I've ever worked with. I'm always trying to be conscious about figuring out what's going on around me and why do I think this would be a good next step to take. And I don't see different theories as being competitors. I think of them as different windows that help me make sense of the same complex reality, that no one theory by itself is really very good at making sense of complex situations. And the more models I have in my head and the more accessible they are to me, the easier it is for me to figure out something useful to do in the moment. And I'm not saying that's going to work for everybody. A lot of the consultants I've worked with have better timing than I do because they don't have to stop and be conscious about what they're doing. They react intuitively in the moment. And I don't have that sense of timing they have. I'm always, for me, the action is always a little bit behind what's really going on. But I'm better at learning from what I do than they are because I am consciously engaged in what I do as I do it. So that's not intended as advice to other people. It's kind of advice for self.
Yeah. Okay. Well, how do you keep track of all those models that you have in your head?
As I come across a new model, I ask myself, what are the bits I disagree with? What would it take for me to agree with it? And so I'm always looking to build a best of both worlds combination between what I already believe and the novel information in whatever model or theory or opinion or whatever it is that I'm looking at. And so I'm deliberately trying to take ideas and build them into the set of models that I already carry around in my head every opportunity I get. If the world would allow me, I would be a theorist and not a practitioner. And it's just that being a practitioner that gives me better data to build my theories out of.
All right. Now, we've probably covered this in great detail, actually. The next question, that's what's the best way to keep a project or a client on track?
To make it their responsibility and not mine.
Yeah, I love that. And we've talked about that in great depth today and the whole action learning and action research methodology, I think, is
right.
Geared towards yes. That. All right, and what's the number one thing you think anyone can do to differentiate themselves?
I haven't ever bothered about that much. if I receive some kind of invitation to get involved in something, I ask myself two questions, and one is this worth doing? And the second thing is, do I have anything to contribute? And if the answer to those two things is yes, then I'll take it on if I have the time for it. And so that means that I really delight in being asked to do things that are close to but not beyond the border of where my present skills and experience might be. So that I'm always looking to extend my experience and build on my skills and use each thing I do to add more to what I already do. And the result is that I really enjoy what I do. I would do this for fun if I wasn't doing it to pay the rent.
And that's always a good way to be. Yeah. All right. Well, thanks, Bob. This has been really fascinating. Now, where can people find out more about you and more about convergent interviewing, more about action learning and action research?
My website is http://www.arl.com.au. The RL is Action Research, Action Learning. And that will give you the front page of my site with a lot of choices about where to go from there. So there's a stack of action research resources, and there's an online action research course, and there's a stack of other things there too. If you're interested in convergent interviewing, if you use preferably Google Scholar, because that gets you into the more academic literature and therefore more rigorous literature. In Google Scholar, if you put convergent interviewing in plain double quotes, Google treats that as a phrase. And that means that almost all of your hits will be relevant. You won't have to fuss it through the early pages looking for stuff that's relevant in amongst a whole lot of irrelevancies. And so to people who use Google a lot, I'd say learn how to use it, because there's a whole lot of special commands in Google that you can use to more easily track down what you're interested in.
Yeah. Well, that's a little golden tip there, putting terms or phrases in inverted commas to get a closer match to what you're actually searching for. So thanks for that. Now, what number one piece of advice would you like to leave our listener today if they want to be a leader in their field and a leader in innovation?
Oh, maybe given the state that the world is in, look for opportunities to share your leadership with others. I think, coming back to that dreadfully complex question you asked a while ago, we're groping our way towards social systems that are shared leadership systems rather than conventional hierarchical systems. And I reckon anything that anyone can do to help that to happen, even in small ways, may help to preserve civilization in some of the threats we face in the years ahead.
Yeah, well, that's great advice, and it kind of comes back to the idea of servant leadership and true leadership, that actually people work to elevate others, which we're not really seeing a lot in our politicians these days. But we'll just leave that comment there. All right. Finally then, Bob, who would you like me to chat with on a future Innova Buzz podcast, and why?
I was thinking about that, and there's a stack of younger facilitators and change agents who are doing really spectacular things. So I thought Catherine Lloyd might be a good choice. Catherine's a skilled facilitator and change agent, and she's also an artist. And so that would give you an extra dimension. She runs her own company called Maverick Minds, and she's really good at process design, so she has better process skills than a lot of people who work in this field, and I think she'll have something very different and very useful to say to you.
Sounds fascinating. So we'll get an introduction to Catherine from you and see if we can get her on the podcast and have a chat with her as well.
And I think she.
So thanks so much for sharing your time and your insights with us so generously today, Bob. I've really enjoyed this, and you know, we've kind of scratched the surface a little bit. There's so much more in action learning, and we didn't really get into convergent thinking or convergent interviewing that much, but it's been fascinating nonetheless, and I've really enjoyed it. So I wish you all the best for the future, and let's keep in touch.
Indeed, I look forward to it. Thank you too for being a really good interviewer. I've enjoyed spending this time with you.
Thanks.
Thank you.
I hope you enjoyed that insightful and informative conversation with Bob and took something away from his episode. We covered a lot of topics, from action learning and research to change management to performance management, stakeholder engagement, convergent interviewing, and I would have loved to dig deeper into some more of those topics that we didn't get to. I particularly loved the idea of building the learning, change, or project together with the teams and how Bob, as a consultant, worked to make himself redundant in the process right from the beginning. I'd love to know what you took away from Bob's episode. Leave a comment below the blog post, which you can find at innovabiz.co/BobDick. That is BobDick, all lowercase, or one word, innovabiz.co/BobDick. You'll also find contact information for getting in touch with Bob there, as well as links to his website that has a whole range of resources, including many that we spoke about in today's conversation. Bob suggested we have a conversation with Catherine Lloyd of Maverick Minds on a future InnovaBuzz podcast. So, Catherine, keep an eye on your inbox for an invitation from us to the InnovaBuzz podcast, courtesy of Bob Dick. Remember to check out our Marketing Master mini class at innovabiz.co/marketingmaster. It's completely free, and most importantly, in less than 30 minutes, you'll gain absolute clarity about who your ideal client is and how you can communicate with them to build and strengthen an engaging, enduring relationship. And if you'd like our help to go even deeper into marketing mastery, or our help with podcast production, then send me an email to jurgen@innovabiz.co. And we'll set up a quick call to have a conversation and find out if indeed we're a good fit for one another. Tune in again next week to the InnovaBuzz podcast, where we've got more fantastic guests lined up, including Rich Everett of Everett Coaching and Michael Simonetti of the digital agency And Mine. Stay connected with us by subscribing to the InnovaBuzz podcast at innovabuzz.com/subscribe, innovabuzz.com/subscribe. Make sure you never miss another episode. It would also mean a lot to me if you leave us a review, because what you think matters. I'd love to hear your thoughts, your ideas, your suggestions, or questions you have, so go ahead and share them in the comments below the blog post for this episode. Until next time, I'm Jürgen Strauss from InnovaBiz. Remember, be awesome and keep innovating.